jump and play. You'll be men and women someday. Then you'll have to leave your world of make-believe. Now, children,
this is the Grassy Knoll on Dade City Micro Radio, AM 1610. You're hearing this on May 2nd, 2005, and this is Visigoth. With us today for this hour is investigative journalist Liam Sheff, who covers stories that are perhaps the most grim of any stories we've had to cover on the Grassy Knoll, but this work has to be done, and Liam is extremely equipped to tackle these issues. And Liam, we want to thank you very much for taking some time out of your busy schedule to be with us on the Grassy Knoll.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thanks very much.
Now, I had not heard of your work. Thankfully, a listener of the show had. And he forwarded me the information I needed to know. And there may be other people, I'm sure, out there who are not quite tuned into what you're doing. So before we get into specifics, can you tell us what is the general focus of the work that you've done?
Yeah, I guess by way of a short illustrative story, I was talking with a friend in a Chinese restaurant in Venice, California, in about 2001, and I was very worried about what I was hearing about AIDS in Africa, and as nonchalantly as you can, he said, "Well, there's no such thing as AIDS in Africa," and I said, "Can you say that again?" And he said, "No, there's no such thing as AIDS in Africa." And I said, "You're insane. Of course there's such a thing as AIDS in Africa. I read about it all the time." He said, "No, I'm not explaining it very well, but just look up a couple of names. Go look up this book by this woman." Well, I was very irritated with him because that's a terrible thing to say to somebody. Of course there's such a thing as AIDS in Africa. And I didn't talk to him for a while, but I had to decide if I was going to be a grown up and look at the material he said I should go look at, and prove him wrong, by the way, that was my intention, or I was just going to feel self-satisfied and that I knew he was an idiot and that was the end of our friendship. Well, I decided to look up the information by a woman named Christine Maggiore. And Christine had written a book called What If Everything You Thought You Knew About AIDS Was Wrong? And I looked at it and I said, "Well, that's amazing. I didn't know." And what he meant by "there's no such thing as AIDS in Africa" wasn't quite an accurate statement, but he meant that the definition of AIDS in Africa was different and always had been different than the definition of AIDS in the United States, and that the definition of AIDS in Africa didn't require HIV testing. I thought, well, that's quite a thing. And that was just something you could find through the official channels in the history books. That's just the way epidemiology works in a country where you can't afford to do testing all over the place. So I went to interview Christine Maggiore, and she is a mom with two lovely, healthy kids and a husband, and it was quite healthy. And he's a filmmaker, and she's a stay-at-home mom, but not quite. She does a lot of other kinds of work. And it turns out that she was HIV positive. Not only was she HIV positive, but she'd been HIV positive for about 12 years at that point. Now it's about 15. And she'd never taken AIDS drugs. Well, I thought, that's interesting. Not surprising, because I don't necessarily believe that drugs are always the answer to a health concern. I do have a lot of experience with people who've recovered from all sorts of illness, multiple sclerosis and cancers and such, by, you know, reducing their toxic load in terms of what they eat and what they consume and how they live. But I was just still kind of impressed. What was even more amazing was the fact that she had tested not only HIV positive, but HIV indeterminate and HIV negative. And I thought, well, now that's really something. So I talked with her, and I found out the reason for all of this. And the reason was that HIV tests were non-standardized. They were non-specific. And they were interpreted rather subjectively according to risk groups. So you have this thing that's called an HIV test, which is an antibody test, which measures just a basic protein response in your body. Now, AIDS researchers like to pretend that this protein response is specific to a particular germ, But they also will admit in the medical literature that it's not. They'll tell you that these tests are not specific, that they come up positive for things like pregnancy, alcoholic liver disease, hepatitis, colds, flus, malaria, tuberculosis, water poisoning, the kind of stuff you get in Africa. I thought, well, that's kind of a lousy test. You know, how'd that ever hit the market? So I kept looking into it and looking into it and looking into it. And the bottom of the well got further and further away. And when I finally sort of reached the bottom, I came all the way through to the point that I understood that just about everything we think we know about AIDS is totally incorrect.
Okay.
And anyway, that's the short version of that story. We can get more into that if you want. The thing that I've been writing about that's now, I guess, in the New York Times is the fact that there's a place in New York City called Incarnation Children's Center. And Incarnation Children's Center is an orphanage. And it was an orphanage that originally took care of what were called border babies. That is, babies born at the hospital and abandoned at the hospital by moms who are on drugs. And this place is in one of the poorer regions of Manhattan, Washington Heights.
Right.
And it was run by nuns, and it started probably with the best of intentions. You know, these nuns were taking care of these kids and loving them and bringing them back to health if they could. Then the AIDS paradigm came along with its non-specific tests, and these kids were suddenly seen as HIV-positive border babies. Now, were they HIV positive, or what is the meaning of HIV positive is really something that's not terribly clear in the medical literature. It's terribly clear in public perception, but it is not what you think it is when you read about it clinically. They could test positive for a lot of reasons, namely their parents were on drugs. It also says in the HIV testing that you can't test children because of the natural transference of antibodies from mothers to children. They have other AIDS, what they call HIV tests, called genetic tests or PCR tests, and people like to claim that those are specific, and I wanted to find out how specific they were, so I, you know, read about them, and it says actually on the package insert of these more specific tests that, the quote, the Amplicor HIV monitor test is not intended to be used as a screening test for HIV, or as a diagnostic test to confirm the presence of HIV infection. This is the Amplicor HIV test. So I thought, well, if that's the test they're using, then, you know, they're sort of making stuff up. They don't know that these kids are going to die or have any particular illness. So what they were doing with these kids was taking them into this place, and at first they were just taking care of them. After a point, though, Incarnation Children's Center, an orphanage for poor black and Hispanic kids in New York City, was joined by the doctor who ran the place, Dr. Stephen Nicholas, as part of Columbia Presbyterian's Clinical Trials Unit. Well, what does that mean? That means that a population of orphans in New York City was going to be used as test subjects for some of the most toxic drugs that exist in the medical canon, because, of course, the view is that AIDS is so terribly debilitating all of the time, regardless of treatment, that you can only use incredibly toxic drugs to treat it. Anyway, I came upon this place, and knowing what I had learned from the medical literature, mind you, not from, you know, somebody telling me at a restaurant, but from the medical literature, that the tests were non-specific cross-reactive antibody tests, knowing that the drugs that were being used, as I found, were actually quite toxic and really weren't AIDS drugs, but were actually chemotherapy drugs. That is, AZT, the drug that's most used in AIDS patients and was the primary and only drug for a long time, was actually recycled from a chemotherapy test lab. It was dumped from, it wasn't even approved when it came out in the 60s because it was just too toxic and it gave all the animals it was tested on cancer or it killed them. But when AIDS came along, when the definition of AIDS came along, it was dumped into that market because people were so desperate for something. Anyway, that's some background. Now we can probably get into specifics. So my background is, I write about AIDS. I write about it from the perspective of what you can find in the medical literature that's not reported on the front page. I write about AIDS drugs, which are incredibly toxic and something that's really never revealed to the public, but incredibly profitable, incredibly profitable. And I write about women who have their kids taken away from them because they don't want to give their children these drugs, or they face getting their kids taken away. And that's what Incarnation Children's Center eventually became, and that's what it is today. A place in New York City where parents who do not want to drug their children have their children housed and drugged and kept and force-fed drugs in a variety of manner.
You know, myself and listeners, too, will be thinking about this, and we always want to know who benefits. Why is this being done? For the financial gain of whatever or whoever?
Well, it goes like this. There's a belief in the culture that pharmaceuticals will sort of save the world. I mean, it's a very strong and widely held belief.
Right.
Like, let's say everything I said was just wrong, and you know, you could prove it all wrong. It's not, but let's say it was, and that HIV was, you know, this thing that was definitely going to kill you, and that the tests were totally accurate and all this other stuff. People believe, based on that, that medical authority, that the NIH, that the CDC, are really saintly, independent organizations trying their very hardest, you know, good old guys and gals rolling up their sleeves, mm-hmm. doing an honest day's work to find the cures for all the things that ail us, like attention deficit disorder and, you know, itchy toe disorder and I eat too much disorder and all the other disorders that we have in America.
Right.
We believe that. So we believe that anything that comes out of them is just almost blessed. You know, we don't think about what these organizations actually are. What they actually are, what the NIH actually is a liaison. The NIH, the National Institutes of Health, a pseudo-public government agency, is actually a liaison for extraordinarily profitable drug companies to the public that they serve or abuse. The NIH's job is to set up some sort of public paradigm. That is, we'll pretend that we're running studies. We'll run them with these companies' drugs. We'll look for any kind of thing that we can get to say that maybe they'd be helpful in certain circumstances. We'll run them through our little friend, the FDA, which is, by the way, owned and operated by people who work at drug companies.
Right.
I mean, the revolving door policy at the FDA is legendary. That is, you can go and work at a drug company and be, you know, a captain of industry at Glaxo or Bristol-Myers Squibb, and then you can resign your post with an agreement with the company that you'll come back in 2 years, by the way, and go and work a stint at the FDA on a drug approval panel. And then you go back to your post. That's the NIH. The CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, the guys that sort of present us with the idea that we're constantly beset by new and unusual viral and bacterial scourges, is a military organization.
Mm-hmm.
It was invented to deal with malaria in this country. And when the malaria problem went away, not ironically, when the majority of the country got sewage reclamation and clean water delivery, something that almost nobody in Africa has, when that problem went away, the CDC didn't decide to go out of business, but they kept on the hunt for new, upcoming, growing diseases. So they're really fixated on it. You know, they anything that they can find, a group of five people in an area, suddenly a new strain of the flu, you know, five people who got food poisoning as a nationwide scare. A guy in New York who did, as this happened recently, a guy in New York who did crystal meth for months at a time and had sex with hundreds of anonymous partners and then took very, very toxic AIDS drugs and got sick, suddenly represents a new strain of HIV.
Right.
Is it a new strain of HIV? Or is it possible that doing crystal meth for 3 months in a row or whatever it was, and then taking carcinogenic AIDS drugs could make you sick on their own? Not according to the CDC. No, it's time to, you know, bang the drums and roll out the bandwagon and get the AIDS thing going again. But I feel like I haven't done service enough to the idea of what AIDS is.
Go ahead.
Well, in the early 80s, in the gay community, a lot of guys got sick, and a lot of guys died. And the lifestyle in the gay community was described clearly in the popular literature at the time, something called the gay lifestyle, the fast lane lifestyle. It's not about being gay. It's about being part of a group which is totally excluded from the rest of society, you know, a group which is treated prejudicially and ghettoized like any minority, so-called minority group is in the country. So the gay community in the 70s was ghettoized. They lived in the gay ghettos. The gay community in this country, unfortunately, defines themselves almost in a kind of a opposition to the straight-laced, Christian, overly dogmatic culture of this country. And they sort of... So when you're in the gay community and you're really feeling like you're not being allowed into the rest of the society, say, okay, well, screw it. I'm going to do what I want. So there's a lot of drug use in the gay community, a lot of party drugs, a lot of drugs like poppers. And poppers is a drug that allows you to have prolonged orgasms and allows you to have penetrative anal sex without pain. It's also a carcinogen, not a mild carcinogen, but a really dangerous carcinogenic drug that was sold over the counter in the gay community as an aphrodisiac. Well, it was known to be a carcinogen. It said fatal if swallowed on the label. And this thing was a mutagen. It actually alters your DNA. These guys were having lots and lots of sex. Again, if you're hated by society, if you're told that you're a sexual deviant by society, at a certain point, the young guys, the guys, you know, who can't quite keep their, you know, nose to the grindstone, and why should they, really, say, well, I'm going to have as much sex as I want. Screw you.
Let me ask you this, Leon. Is it that then, that more or less when they feel like they are, well, and are ostracized?
No, they are ostracized.
Yeah, that a mindset of almost nihilism comes in.
There is a nihilistic mindset, right, in the gay community that that's difficult to match. You know, you really almost, you can almost not find it anywhere else. And it took me a while, spending time with a lot of my friends who were gay, people I knew who were gay, people who weren't my friends, they would just talk with me as interview subjects, to find out that there's a belief in the gay community that's been projected onto the gay community, which is that gay is wrong, that gay is evil. You know, for the majority of Western history, if you were gay in a Western culture, you had a very short life expectancy.
Mm-hmm.
You were either made to serve, you know, somebody in a way that maybe didn't make you feel very good about yourself, or you were beaten to death, you know, or you were made a witch and, you know, burned in some fashion. When AIDS came along, it was originally called GRID, gay-related immune disease. Now, the reason they called it GRID was because there were illnesses that were occurring in the gay community only. And the diseases were originally blamed in the CDC report on reports on GRID on toxicology, that is, massive consumption of cocaine, ecstasy, amphetamines, poppers, and antibiotics. Now, these guys were popping antibiotics like you might pop vitamin C. You know, antibiotics were sold. Again, this is covered in the literature at the time, especially by some good reporters like Ian Young and John Lauritsen, who used to write at the New York Native. Antibiotics were sold in the sex, at the baths, which were basically the gay sex clubs.
Right.
So you could go, and if you felt like you were going to have a lot of sex, you felt like you had a cold coming on, you would go and take black market tetracycline, which would totally kill any helpful bacteria in your intestine, which makes you a paper thin. I mean, you can be infected by almost anything at that point. Then you mix that with poppers, and you get a carcinogenic mix. Mm. Well, these guys started having a kind of cancer called Kaposi's sarcoma. Well, there were doctors at the time saying, we think this is probably caused by the poppers. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't, but that's what they said. Then a guy came along called Robert Gallo. And Robert Gallo had worked in cancer, trying to prove that cancer was caused by a virus. Now, he'd failed, and he'd actually been sort of caught on being fraudulent, and he'd had his work called into question. But this new thing was big. You know, this new thing had the potential at the CDC, where they're always looking for something to grab onto. You can actually look at the CDC. There's a CDC document at the time that lists the problem in the gay community, and it says in the handwriting, this is hot stuff. Like, that's the mentality. You know, they look for a disease. This is hot stuff. We got a lot of guys coming up with infections and with this cancer. This is hot stuff. We can really make this into something. So Gallo decided, never mind the toxicity, never mind the lifestyle, never mind anything else that was going on, decided that AIDS, what was then called GRID, was going to be transmitted by a virus, but not just a normal virus, a retrovirus. Why? Because Robert Gallo had been working with things that he believed were retroviruses. Now, he'd never isolated one or proved that one caused cancer. In fact, he'd proved the opposite. He'd failed to prove it, and he'd been embarrassed in his research. And this is, again, well documented in the record. But something special happened, and that special thing was that the Christian right came down hard on what was called GRID and later called AIDS and said, this is God's punishment against fags.
Yeah, right.
Well, of course it wasn't God's punishment against, you know, this was a cumulative lifestyle poisoning toxicity based on all the things we described, you know, internalized homophobia, the ostracism from the culture, chronic drug abuse, all the other things that were happening. By the way, when these guys got sick and went into the hospital, they weren't nursed back to health, because modern medicine doesn't know how to nurse anybody back to health. The paradigm of medicine is to kill it, whatever it is. And if it kills you in the process, if we kill you in the process of killing it, we're sorry.
Right.
That's it. That's called chemotherapy. So these guys who had no immune systems left, been destroying their own immune systems, partying nonstop for years, came into the hospital, and instead of being given an infusion of healthy essential fatty acids and vitamins and probiotics to repopulate their intestines, were given actual chemotherapy. I mean, actual radiation mm-hmm. chemotherapy, because they had the KS. Now, if you take an extraordinarily sick person who's not had a good meal in a couple of years, who's not slept properly for a couple of years, who doesn't eat, who's drugged up beyond belief, and you put them under radiation, they're going to die. And that's what happened. And the guys who had lung infections, because they were using all these nitrite inhalants, were given pentamidine. And pentamidine is a surface antifungal drug. It's something you apply on the surface. They were injected with this stuff, and their limbs blackened, and they died. So a lot of guys died in early AIDS. Robert Gallo decided this was viral. Now, at this point, any sane person would be saying, what makes you think that what we're looking at is a single-cause illness? There's certainly a lot going on here, even if there is a virus in the body. There's a lot going on here. Not so to Robert Gallo and what they call the virus hunters. They had their people. So Robert Gallo didn't find a virus in them, but he created a test based on proteins that he took from a group of gay men. Not one gay man, but a group of gay men that he mixed with his old cancer cell experiments, and he patented that test, and that's called an HIV test. That's it. That's what an HIV test is. When you go to take an HIV test, you're being tested against proteins that Robert Gallo or some other person in subsequent experiments found in a variety of people who were sick for a variety of reasons. And the proteins that you test against come up positive for just about everything in the medical literature. I mean, you know, colds, flus, yeast infections will all make these things come up positive, because all these tests find is an antibody reaction in your blood. So I've been researching this, and I found this out. And I thought there was a lot to this, but it still didn't quite answer the question about Africa, which my friend had presented to me in 2001 in the restaurant in Venice.
Yes, right.
And I looked, and there it was, right there again in the literature. What happened in Africa was that in 1985, a year, not even a year after the announcement was made that HIV probably, that's the way they put it, was the probable cause of AIDS in gay men and hemophiliacs, and anybody else that they decided to test with these nonspecific, very reactive antibody tests. but it was also being looked at as the cause of illness in Africa. Now, you and I were both alive in the 70s, right?
That's right.
I remember the bombardment of commercials and crass jokes about the death rate in Africa, about poverty, malnutrition, starvation, the likelihood of dying there, the children on television with no muscle fiber on their bones and distended stomachs. They even had medical names for it, like
kwashiorkor.
Yeah.
That's right, yeah.
Well, okay. What happens in 1985 is the World Health Organization held a meeting in Bangui, the capital of the Central African Republic. And this meeting was presided over by a United States CDC official, our friend the CDC, looking for problems. Not trying to solve them, just trying to scare the living daylights out of us. The official was called Joseph McCormick, and he actually wrote about this meeting in his book. And his book is called, and this is just the most exciting title you could ever think, Level 4 Virus Hunters of the CDC.
Very sexy, yeah.
Very sexy. And this is his quote from his book. If I could get everyone at the WHO, World Health Organization, meeting in Bangui to agree on a single, simple definition of what an AIDS case was in Africa, then, imperfect as the definition might be, we could actually start counting the cases. What does that mean? That means that a year after a non-specific screening test was patented and sold in the United States, the United States government went to Africa and decided that a disease that occurred exclusively among guys in the gay community who were using tons of drugs, or hemophiliacs who were constantly bombarded by the toxicity of chronic infusions and drugs to maintain their health, was suddenly going to affect the entire African populace. And let me tell you, 20 years later, we don't know anything different. As far as kids who were born today, Africa is synonymous with AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
This happened in 1985. The way that they decided, by the way, to define AIDS in Africa is the way that they still do, clinically. If you have a cough, if you're losing weight, if you have diarrhea, if you're itching, or vomiting, you have AIDS. You don't need to test. When they talk about 80 million infections, they're not saying that they've tested 80 million people. And if you ask any good epidemiologist, they would throw back their head and laugh. Of course we can't test 80 million people.
Right.
We can't test a million people. So who do they test? They test pregnant mothers, pregnant women, at natal clinics, in rural areas and in cities, the only place where there are medical structures to collect blood. And they test these with these highly reactive tests that you can't even use in the United States to determine HIV positivity. They then take that result and they expand it to the rest of the population. And if you think I'm making this up, this is on the front page of the Boston Globe last year, if I can find it. Here it is. The June 20th, 2004 Boston Globe reported that, quote, the current estimate of 40 million people living with AIDS virus worldwide is inflated by 25% to 50%. They were quoting a CDC official saying that. They pointed out that HIV estimates for entire countries have for over a decade been taken from blood samples from pregnant women at prenatal clinics. June 20th, 2004, Boston Globe. But it's not just HIV estimates that are created from testing pregnant women. It's, quote, AIDS deaths, AIDS orphans, number of people needing antiretroviral treatment, and the average life expectancy, all from that one test. What is AIDS in Africa? It is synonymous with malaria in Africa, with tuberculosis in Africa. It is, by the way, synonymous with capitalism in Africa, with colonialism in Africa, mm-hmm. with forcing people in Africa to grow sugar and to dig out coal and to forego growing peas and quinoa and wheat and other things that and millet, things that you can actually eat and survive there.
Right.
What we have in Africa is a group of countries which are still being used as the labor force mm-hmm. and as raw material for the quote civilized world, for the whites in Europe and America, South America. What we now have in Africa on the part of the left is a concern that a sexually transmitted virus is so smart and sneaky that it managed to infect every single black person and skip every single straight, heterosexual, healthy, well-fed white person.
Right.
And that the cure for this is to take drugs like AZT, a chemotherapy drug, shelved 40 years ago, resuscitated like Frankenstein, dumped into the market, and now dumped into pregnant women, even though it says on the label that AZT causes death, even though it's known in the medical literature that AZT causes spontaneous abortion, that it causes birth defects, brain damage in children.
Liam, let me ask you at this juncture also, and let me say before we go any further, this is the Grassy Knoll on Dade City Micro Radio, 8 a.m., 1610. This is Viz, and we're with Liam Sheff, an investigative journalist, and we're talking about some, as we said, some very grim issues that must be talked about. Liam, if people, and they're going to probably be on the Internet while they're listening to this, are there places, more specific, where they can read your work?
You can look at my two most recent articles at GNN, GorillaNewsNetwork.tv, GNN.tv. I just wrote a two-part series for them called The Hidden Face of HIV, which really walk you through everything I just said. The first piece is called Knowing is Beautiful, because MTV and VH1, with sponsorship from drug companies, are running ad campaigns on their networks, and you see these in cities on billboards, called Knowing is Beautiful, knowhiv.org, it's K-N-O-W, hiv.org, which encourage people to go out and get tested. So the article is called Knowing is Beautiful, and I just wanted to explore what the medical literature said about testing. And in the medical literature you find, you know, quotes like this. Reasons for positive HIV test result include transfusions, transplantation, pregnancy, autoimmune disorders, malignancies, alcoholic liver disease, or for reasons that are unclear. You find quotes like causes of indeterminate Western blots. Now, Western blot tests are another antibody test which are claimed to verify the first test. They know the first test is crap. So they use another test, which is actually the same test, but the proteins in the test are reorganized. So the causes of indeterminate Western blot tests include lymphoma, multiple sclerosis, injection drug use, liver disease, or autoimmune disorders. Also, there appear to be healthy individuals with antibodies that cross-react. You can find that in the article Knowing is Beautiful at GNN.TV. The second article at GNN.TV is called Sex Crimes, because the contention is, of course, that HIV is a sexually transmitted virus. In the medical literature, it's very difficult to prove that. It's been said that. What you do find is that people who have lifestyles in common, poverty, you know, stress, drug use, tend to get sick in the same way. But in long-term studies, such as the study done at the University of California, Berkeley, from 1987 to 1997, out of 172, what was it? Let's see if I can find 175 couples, one who tested positive and one who tested negative, exactly zero people turned up positive who, you know, that is converted from negative to positive.
Mm-hmm.
Over a 10-year study among couples who admitted to not using condoms. So sexual transmission is, although it's in the popular sense is considered the most obvious way that HIV, whatever it is, transmits itself, it's really difficult to prove that in the medical literature. What you do find, though, is that the HIV tests, again, this is in the article Sex Crimes, HIV tests are interpreted based on the assumption that something's sexually transmitted.
Mm-hmm.
So this means that if I, say I'm straight, white, well-fed heterosexual, go in for a test, and they ask me if I've had any unusual sexual occurrences, I say no. I use a condom, and I only have sex with my girlfriend, who I'm going to marry. I'm in what's called a low-risk group.
Right.
And by definition, my test is considered to be less likely to be accurate. No, I'll just say that again because that seems like I'm making it up. But right. this is how the medical literature asks doctors to interpret the results of their non-specific tests. Tests are either going to be reactive to a certain degree or non-reactive to a certain degree. You go and you give your blood. They pull out the proteins just by swirling, by clotting the blood, and they take the plasma from it and they mix it in these tests with these other proteins, and some of the proteins will grab onto each other. What does that reaction mean? It doesn't mean a thing, but it means something for some groups. The groups that it means something for are groups that are assumed by the definition of AIDS to be at risk. So if you're black, Hispanic, poor, drug using, or gay, your test is considered to be more likely to be accurate, accurate than my test. So if my test comes up and it's reactive, they're going to say my test is more likely to be a mistake or what they call false positive. If your test is reactive and you're, say, a gay man, of course your test has a high positive predictive value. We consider your test to be highly accurate. If you're in a high-risk group and you have a non-reactive test, guess what happens? They consider your test to be not a negative, but a false negative. Because they've already decided that you're probably infected before you ever tested.
So these clinical studies that are supposed to be objective, obviously, because they're based on science, are actually interpreted through a prism of cultural bias.
There's a sociologic filter that is about a mile deep. But I was talking with a friend of mine, a teacher up here, I'm in Seattle right now, who was telling me that he just loved science. And I said, yeah, well, you know, where are you going to look for science these days? I say, when what I write about in medicine, and he stopped me. He said, medicine isn't science. Medicine is junk science. Medicine is people pretend using the language of science to sell drugs. And I said, I couldn't have said it better myself.
That's right.
So anyway, you get these nonspecific tests. Person, you know, in a high-risk group, like a black child born in New York City to a drug abuser, is going to be considered a priori, that is, before you ever do anything, to be considered to be more likely to be HIV-infected.
Right, on theory,
than
right. right.
Now, if anybody wants to look this up, the rule that's being used or abused here is a statistical rule called Bayes rule, B-A-Y-E-S apostrophe rule, Bayes rule. So the kids at Incarnation Children's Center, this orphanage in New York, never really had a chance to be HIV negative because that's not how testing works.
Right.
They were tested with a test that doesn't prove anything based on an assumption that a test in them means something. At that point, and even before, and even in utero, before they were born, they were drugged with drugs that are known to destroy their bone marrow, to destroy their ability to live, to cause wasting and what's called lipodystrophy, that is the really grotesque distribution of fat around the body to suck it out of the limbs, and it seems to reaccumulate in the fat in the back. It's called a buffalo hump. This is what they call it in the medical literature, a buffalo hump, if you can believe that.
Yeah.
And they blame it on the drugs, the protease inhibitors. So, you know, I found out about Incarnation Children's Center. I was told that there was a mom had contacted my friend Christine Maggiore and said, my kids are being taken away because I don't want to give them AZT and these other drugs. And I went and looked into it, and I found that Incarnation Children's Center was actually a clinical trial subunit of the NIH, was running clinical trials with 7-8 drugs in combination on orphan populations, and that when the kids didn't want to take the drugs, the kids took the drugs anyway. What I mean by that is the current paradigm, the current the modus operandi right now in AIDS medicine and some other very kinds of toxic forms of medicine, is that when a child doesn't want to take the drugs, they're given the drugs through a tube, and that tube either goes up through the nose and down into the stomach, or what's considered more effective by these doctors is actually to take the children in for surgery and to cut a hole in their abdomen, to put a plastic tube through it, to sew it the flesh around the tube, and to seal off the tube at the end as it protrudes from the body. Then, at regular intervals throughout the day, they can be given the drugs through a syringe and fed through a stomach tube, fed Pediasure, a really noxious, really grotesque mixture of lipids and milk solids and vitamins. And that this is supposed to ensure the health of children who've tested HIV positive.
But Liam, I mean, this is almost like something out of Dachau. You know, when you look at this whole thing with the CDC and all that's taking place, I'm not going to lead you where you don't want to go, but it almost sounds like some kind of institutional depopulation of a specific target group.
Well, you know.
I mean, is that what we're dealing with?
Well, what do you say? You either believe your eyes or you don't. When I talked to the doctor who ran the place, oh, by the way, this is called a G-tube. If you want to look it up on the web, it's called a G-tube. And you can find it in the medical literature. The best way to get children to adhere to this medical therapy is through a G-tube. And I quote this stuff, and I talked to the doctor who runs Incarnation Children's Center, and she told me exactly how the surgery was performed. And to her, it might have been a little uncomfortable to talk about, but it wasn't controversial because, she told me, if we don't do this, of course these children will die. Well, it turns out that more children with the tubes die than children who don't have the tubes. Now, this is from the some nurses and healthcare workers at the place and the mothers and the kids who I've talked to from the place. They say the kids with the tubes don't do as well. They die more quickly. They get sicker. So is the doctor correct or are you correct? Does it seem that we're targeting certain populations? Well, look, we are targeting certain populations. If you believe what you read in the media, every black person in this country is now suddenly at risk for AIDS. Why is that? Because we believe they are and because we're going to test them more. And you have to remember that HIV positivity will increase in any group that you consider to be more likely to be HIV positive. That is, as soon as you test more, how do I say this? HIV positivity is an artifact of HIV testing.
Right.
You test more people, you say, by your interpretation of the value of the test, that they are more likely to be at risk. Therefore, their tests have a higher predictive value. Therefore, more people in that group are going to be positive. You've just created a win-win situation for yourself in proving your point. But it is circular, deadly, false logic. Because if you decided to test more people in the white population, and when this happens, by the way, alarm bells go off. And I found something in the clinical, in the AIDS literature that was sort of surprising to me. This is from a magazine called AIDS Alert from March 1998, and this article was talking about the new HIV tests, which are rapid tests, which are now the ones being used in clinics in poor neighborhoods and on homeless people and in Africa. It says this, whether the tests will perform as well in the United States as they have abroad is still unknown. For one thing, using a single rapid test in a low prevalence population, that's a low risk population, where they believe that very few people are at risk, will give a lower positive predictive value. They mean that there'll be more false positives. That error rate, they say, won't matter much in areas with a high prevalence of HIV. And see if you can follow the logic of this. Because in all probability, the people testing false positive will have the disease.
Yeah.
But if the same test was performed on 1,000 white, affluent, suburban housewives, a low prevalence population, in all likelihood, all positive results will be false.
So this is front-loaded with an assumption.
This is front-loaded with an assumption. This is from AIDS Alert, March 1998. The article is called Coming to Your Clinic, Candidate for Rapid Tests, and it's in the article Sex Crimes at GNN.TV, in case you think I, you know, was fabricating something. No, that's just how it works, ladies and gentlemen. So, yeah, it's a front-loaded assumption. Now, anybody who you talk to about this, who really believes in the HIV paradigm, and by the way, a lot of this comes from the gay community, because the gay community sort of now, how do I say this without saying it?
Say it.
Yeah. The gay community right now is, in many ways, responsible for the populist front of AIDS, because they brought in they accepted the idea that they had a sexually transmitted virus. Now, it's been covered and reported, as far as the New York Times, that the rate and the risk of heterosexuals, non-drug users, etc., getting AIDS is negligible, almost zero, in this country. And that it's, in this country, mostly a gay disease. Why is it a gay disease? It's because gay men regularly go in to get tested. It's because gay men buy into the idea that once they test positive, they should go on very, very toxic drug combinations.
Mm-hmm.
The gay community benefits from AIDS in a particular way. And I know that sounds heinous to people, and it is heinous. They benefit in this way. Before AIDS, there was no gay community. Gay people were not protected. Gay men especially were not protected in the culture. So AIDS has provided, I know this is rather grotesque, but this is what was told to me by people in the gay community, over and over again, in fact. AIDS has provided a safety network, a sense of community, a sense of belonging, a reason to cry foul in prejudice when you know people are treating gay people prejudicially. AIDS is a safety net, but it is also a death curse. I mean, without a doubt, it is a death curse, not a death sentence, but a death curse. You invoke this test, you believe that it's true,
right.
You go on these drugs, and you die. Or you surround yourself with people who believe that if you have a non-specific test, you're going to waste your days away in the company of the people who love you. That is just so profoundly nihilistic, but it is absolutely the way that it's working.
Liam, I was going to say, I don't agree with the lifestyle, but that's my feeling. I don't persecute, nor do I strike out against anyone or want to see anyone done away with because they have a lifestyle I don't agree with. I never bought the fact that AIDS was connected to that. What I see is that there's a group of people who are being targeted for, as you say, nihilism and extermination. And the reason that's important, I would say, for all of us, and I don't believe in what the religious televangelists you were saying about how this is breaking God's law, okay? So what I'm going back to is this. If they target them, they're going to target other people. It's not right for them, and if they do that, they're going to bring it to a neighborhood near you.
Well, they are. That's exactly what's happening right now. It is coming to a neighborhood near all of us.
That's right.
And the CDC is really getting excited about these new rapid tests because they work in about 20 minutes. And it's now possible to walk into a poor neighborhood or even a middle-class neighborhood or a hospital in a middle-class neighborhood and to have a dialogue with a mother who you consider to be at risk. Why? Because she's Hispanic, because she comes from another country,
mm-hmm.
because she had a blood transfusion recently, because she cheated on her husband and feels guilty about it. And to run one of these tests, which on suburban, wealthy, affluent white women are going to be false positives, but on everybody else, even if they're false negative, they're still going to. I mean, even if they're negative, they're still going to have the disease, according to the guys giving the test. Now, there is no AIDS disease. I mean, there was always a hypothesis that HIV, whatever it was, nobody's ever isolated a unique virus called HIV. By the way, people have found proteins in different people, and they've accumulated those into an academic model of a virus. People have found small particles in cell cultures that have really been worked over in the lab that can't be replicated easily and don't occur in the cells of people who you say are AIDS patients. You cannot go up to 100 AIDS patients and take a simple sample of their blood and find the same virus in all of them. Now, scientists get very huffy about all this. They say, well, HIV is a wily virus. It mutates. It can't be found, and yet it's the most deadly virus in the world. It's either a strong virus that kills you and can be found, or it ain't. And the likelihood is that it's not. The likelihood is that this is a multifactorial illness, and sure, you can find viral particles and all sorts of particles in all sorts of people. It doesn't mean that those particles are, we're made of these particles. We produce these particles. We produce what are called viral particles. We used to call them retrovirus. Now people are calling them retrotransposons, and they believe they're an absolutely essential part of our genetic functioning and the way that our cells communicate and build. Most of the AIDS drugs, by the way, destroy anything associated with normal genetic functioning. That's why they're so deadly. They actually work on the genetic level. They're like bombs. They just enter your cell and blow them up. It's nasty stuff. But AIDS doctors don't want to hear about this. HIV causes AIDS. Of course, it's not multifactorial, even though there's no specific AIDS disease. And they'll say that HIV affects T cells, even though they have never proven that HIV affects T cells, even though T cells go up and down according to time of day, even though you can live with very low T cells, even though T cells are only a subgroup of all your white blood cells. They've been made into this kind of religious icon by people who buy into the AIDS thing. So the New York Times finally got around to covering the Incarnation Children's Center story, and they were nice enough, like most big publications, to leave out my name, because if you include my name, you have to hear the whole story. But it turns out that there's, you know, being an investigation is now underway or about to commence on the clinical trial aspect of Incarnation Children's Center. And that's all well and good, especially for public consumption. But the reality is that the clinical trials were nothing more than the daily regimen switched around a little bit. There was nothing in the clinical trials, with a couple exceptions of some vaccines that they were injecting these kids with, which are important to talk about. But for the most part, were nothing more than the daily regimen in different combinations. And that's exactly what all AIDS drug clinical trials are. There are no new AIDS drugs. There are three classes. They produce drugs within these classes that do the same things as previous ones. They try to reduce toxicity, but it's really hard because the nature of the drug is to interrupt genetic functioning or the assemblage of proteins in your body. There's no way to make that non-toxic, you know, to stop your body from building itself. That's a toxic process.
Let me ask you to clarify. AIDS is a real thing, but it's not gotten to by what we think leads to it, the causative agents.
AIDS is a clinical definition that's been expanded and expanded and expanded by the CDC to include now 30 illnesses in this country, with or without, by the way, HIV testing, innumerable illnesses in other countries. AIDS is a real thing in as much as illness is a real thing. But it's not, there's no specific illness called AIDS. They'll tell you that there's a clinical definition for it, and that is when they measure your T cells and they fall below a certain arbitrary number, a very arbitrary number. It's a low number, but it's not significant of any. Your T cells can go up and down if you smoke, if you're pregnant, if you get too much ultraviolet rays, if you get too much sun. There's a clinical definition of AIDS that's as fakakta as any other part of the thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, if you want to finish up your thought, I might have derailed you.
Ahead.
Well, I mean, as we're getting down to our last 6 or 7 minutes, and again, I don't know this is necessarily your bailiwick, but here's what's disturbing to me. You know, we call the CDC the Center for Disease Creation.
Yeah.
In 1985, I believe that was the right year, they were more than helpful in giving Saddam the bioweapons he wanted to go against Iran with. But there's also something else that's happening here in America, and that is the CDC really does produce, oftentimes, with regard to a bio attack in the United States, some very draconian statements, like corralling people for their own good. And, of course, we birthed this this legislation called the Emergency Health Powers Act. Are you familiar with that at all?
No, go ahead.
No, it's just that it's one of these cases, and it was drafted in back of the anthrax scare we had a couple of years ago, in which they pretty much, depending on the state you're in and the version they wanted to draft, could just go into your house, grab your butt if you didn't want to get vaccinated, and bring you to a center to quarantine you or forcibly vaccinate you. And this is in back of the CDC's determination. I find this very scary. So if you extrapolate, I don't want to diminish the focus of your work, which is especially on the children at the ICC. But do you see where this is going? It's like they've almost become some kind of unapproachable, inviolate organization that is almost as powerful, if not more so, than your government.
Well, yeah, I liken it to the church. the left gave up religion a while ago because, you know, for whatever reason,
it didn't work for them.
It didn't work for them. They thought they were too smart, and they liked what science said. And science as it is, presents a more morally flexible universe than religion, which is often really punitive. So people on the left still have a spiritual need, and I think that they subvert it unconsciously. This is, you know, you can read this in other people's work, like Rupert Sheldrake. I think they really sublimate it into an absolute worship at the Church of Science.
Yes.
And so you get guys from the CDC walking into a neighborhood saying, you all need to get this mercury-filled formaldehyde-based crap thrust into your butts. Well, okay, if you say so. You do get a lot of the United States, and I've been writing about this. You know, the people who are most alarmed by what's going on, what I've uncovered, are people who really don't buy into the idea that science is inviolate. They don't buy into the idea that science really knows that much more about the world than any other field of inquiry. Now, they will make assumptions about religion that I won't agree with, because I don't think that, you know, I mean, I think there are spiritual things that you can't really frame literally without losing the meaning. But you know, I do enjoy my own spiritual life and those sort of connections. But it's funny to me the clash that goes on between religion and science today, especially, you know, you see this especially in the argument over evolution. And you get people who don't know anything about the actual arguments in evolution stating that evolution has been proven and that it's actually factually this, that, and the other thing. And you get people on the other side saying, no, it's all God's plan. The fact is, evolution is an imperfect concept with a lot of great evidence to support it. I mean, there's a lot of good evidence to support it, but it's never really finished its argument. Because it can't, because it excludes the possibility that there's a creative element in the universe, and science can't handle the creative element in the universe side. So the people on the right want to say that that creative element is a guy in the sky. I don't think that's true either, but, you know, as metaphor goes, I guess, you know, a lot of people buy into it. People need to worship something, and they're either going to worship at the altar of religion or at the altar of medicine. I would strongly advise people to take a good look at their gods and their goddesses, and I mean the CDC and the NIH,
right.
And to stare into the eyes and see if you can see the crack, you know, in the iris. You see if you can see the faults, because if you really believe that it's not possible that medicine can make a mistake, then you may, you know, then you're practicing a religion. I mean, because belief shouldn't have anything to do with science. Unfortunately, it has everything to do with science.
Also, and I want to get some more information out as we are on our last 2 minutes.
Yeah.
But I focus a lot that nowadays on Huxley's projection of a scientific dictatorship and the trust that we place in science as being, you know, the all honest, all truthful entity. But now, Orphans on Trial can be read on heal.org. That's altheal.org. Orphans on Trial, very heart-wrenching. Really, folks, I mean, we could not educate in an hour, Liam, you know, all that's going on, so let them read about you without a doubt. Let me ask you this before we go. Are you planning a book or anything?
Writing a book. The book will be out probably by year's end or the beginning of next year, and I'm writing it with a lot of people who've spoken with me. By the way, it's not, in a sense, my book. It's not a book about dismantling HIV/AIDS theory. The book is about the people who've come forward to me and said, I don't like the drugs that I'm on. Kids, adults, who said, I don't like what's happening here. That's really all I can do at this point to get people's attention, because if you believe the so-called science of it, you know, it's difficult to look at the reality on the ground.
Well, Liam Sheff, thank you for being with us at the Grassy Knoll. Thank you for tackling this subject. There's not a lot of victories in this, per se, except that you get the truth out. We thank you that you do that, and long may you run.
Yeah, well, give me a call. Well, this flew by, so have me back on in a couple of months.
We're more than happy to do so.
That was fun.
All right. If you'll excuse me, God bless you.
Bless you, too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.